With few people buying cars, Obama buys a car company.
Our government will be making a significant additional investment of about $30 billion in GM, an investment that will entitle American taxpayers to ownership of about 60% of the new GM.
Didn't he talk about that during the campaign, the joys of ownership?
In Washington, they call this the ownership society. But what it really means is that you're on your own.
Bankrupt GM gets a new boss. The federal regulator is now also the owner. The agonies of ownership as the lawyers try to figure out who can do what and to whom. Can I get a car named after me? How about the four-door, four-cylinder, all-electric Takeaway?
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Love the Finns. Good morning. It's Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up, finding deeper meaning in the workplace. A philosopher of the workplace talks about jobs all over the world in this 21st century global economy. Also, summer TV, a wasteland of garbage, we'll find out. And lightning hits airplanes. It's terrifying, and we'll talk to a flight engineer about what it actually means. All this and more ahead, but first the headlines. And in the headlines, the Senate's back to work. That means people whose future depends on it are stopping by today. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will meet with top lawmakers, a tradition for high court nominees. She'll first visit Senate Democrat Harry Reid and also meet with his Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell. The administration wants to get Sotomayor confirmed before the Senate's August break. Republicans say they're in no rush. Today's other Senate pilgrim is Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal. He's slated to take over command of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Like Sotomayor, he also needs Senate confirmation, and he's not likely to face serious opposition. Fire on the water, that's what a commercial pilot may have seen along the route flown by the missing Air France jet. Still not clear what happened to the Rio to Paris flight with 228 people on board. Officials lost contact with it not long after it reported electrical problems. The passengers, including two Americans, are all feared dead. Femi, okay? What else is out there in the headlines?
Good morning, everybody. South Korean media is reporting that Kim Jong-il has named his youngest son as the next leader of North Korea. Speculation about who could lead the country next is hot right now, amid questions about Kim Jong-il's health. Like most things North Korean, little is known about his son. Intelligence officials say that he's in his mid-20s, but it may be years before anything changes. The last succession in North Korea was decided 20 years before it happened.
New leader probably named Kim. Probably, just, you know, guessing.
His name is Kim Jong-un.
Kim, right. Somebody.
It's good to keep the family name going.
Yes, indeed. There you go.
Meanwhile, this news comes as other reports in the South Korean media say that Pyongyang is readying two more missile tests. Healthcare is high on President Obama's agenda today. He is meeting with Senate Democrats this afternoon to talk about getting costs under control. And then tonight he leaves for his Middle East trip. In sports, hockey Stanley Cup final continues tonight. The Detroit Red Wings lead the Pittsburgh Penguins in the series 2-0.
Some good news for Detroit and good news for Detroit. The S&P and the Dow both grew more than 2.5% yesterday. The S&P opens at 942. Dow starts trading at 87.21. Later on, we're going to talk about the poetry of the workplace in the 21st century. Does work vie with love as the principal source of life's meaning? An author talks about that later. What do you think? At 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Later on in the program, I suppose you all are getting ready for work, those of you who aren't unemployed in this complex economy. But later on in the program, Alain de Botton is going to join us. He's a philosopher, a fabulous writer, and he's written a book called The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And in it is this quote, and I want you to think about it for the next hour. He wanted to write a hymn to the intelligence, peculiarity, beauty, and horror of the modern workplace, and not least its extraordinary claim, the workplace that is, to being able to provide us, alongside love, with the principal source of life's meaning. Do you buy that? I alluded to it a moment ago. Do you buy that? Is love and work the principal source of life's meaning? If you think so, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Agree or disagree, we welcome all stories at thetakeaway.org, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Well, the workplace at General Motors changed a little bit yesterday, and Barack Obama posed this question to all of us. As taxpayers, we basically own General Motors. Is it possible to own more than half of something and not be directly involved with how it's managed? The president says, sure.
In short, our goal is to get GM back on its feet, take a hands-off approach, and get out quickly.
Well, the workplace of General Motors includes large swashes of Washington as of this morning. Joining us now is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. I guess we wouldn't call the acquisition of GM part of the inheritance. He actually went out and bought this, David. Good morning.
Well, you know, John, you could say that he certainly inherited the problem and he's trying to buy his way out of it. So you've got all these people in Washington these days who are waking up running GM and basically screaming, as the president himself did yesterday, that's okay. We really don't want to own it.
Well, let's talk for a minute. The challenge for me in the 8 minutes and 30 seconds that we have is to have a coherent conversation about two things that struck me yesterday, and you've written about them this morning in the paper. One is how in the federal environment that we've known for, you know, a century now, where the federal government is essentially a regulator, not an owner, but it does create rules for industrial companies, even though it doesn't actually own them. How is the federal government to regulate the auto industry on things like emission standards, even workplace questions, if it owns General Motors and doesn't own, say, Ford? What's the situation there? It seems to me a head-scratcher.
It sure does. And, you know, the situation that you described is only, to my mind, the beginning of the problem. Because let's say for a moment that somehow President Obama is able to pull this off, that he is able to enact the principles that this study I wrote about this morning that was done by some of his aides about the rules of the road for being a government shareholder actually get put in place. And what are the rules? The rules are no day-to-day management, be very activist at the beginning, appoint a board of directors and, you know, all that you need along those lines, but do not run the place with decisions being made at the White House about, as one of the president's aides put it to me, you know, no decisions about where to put car plants and no decisions about what color to make the cars. Okay. And the last big principle that they set was that they would, of course, get out quickly. So how do you do that when the rest of the world looks at this and says, oh, yeah, we've seen this before. It's, you know, the French owning a big part of Peugeot or, you know, any other nationalized car maker. So if our rules make it difficult for some reason for, say, the Chinese to bring cars into the United States, isn't the rest of the world going to say, oh, sure, you're just protecting your state-owned car maker?
Well, there's a World Trade Organization to deal with that. I guess I'm more concerned with Alan Mulally at Ford, who wakes up this morning and says, the World Trade Organization isn't going to protect me. I'm stuck here. GM's favored. I'm on the one who's on my own.
Well, the argument on the other side of that, and I'm not saying I agree with this, I'll just tell you how it's been answered to me when I've asked the question, is that Ford was given an opportunity to receive government help and concluded that it didn't want it, and it didn't want the restrictions that go with it, and so that they made a choice. But certainly, if, you know, 3 years from now, Ford looks in tougher shape than GM, then that could be a problem. Now, I'm not certain that that's a realistic issue, because GM's got a long way to go. I mean, here they are getting rid of four of their eight lines, right?
Right.
Pontiac's going to go away. The Hummer's going to go. I don't know where you're going to fix your Hummer, John, but
yeah.
But you're going to have to find another place, right?
I know. It's terrible. I tried to do it myself. It's rough.
You know, so you're going to have these go away, and GM has got a lot more ground to make up in the area of building small cars that are, you know, highly efficient. And this is the place where I think the conflict between ownership and government objectives could be the greatest. The president already stepped out and said, we're going to make small, fuel-efficient, low-carbon footprint cars and make them in the United States. Well, supposing the company comes back and says, you know, Mr. President, our most profitable cars are those big gas guzzlers like Hockenberry drives, you know, and we might need a good mix of those if we're going to get back to profitability.
Well, if for instance, the models do change, and I'll ignore the gas guzzler reference for just a moment, since I do own a Toyota, but and an Audi, actually, come to think of it. You know, can Ford make the claim that General Motors is being favored here in some sense, that that the environment for product development for GM is easier than it is for Ford, and actually sue the government on that basis?
I'm not sure what the suit would be because, as I said, Ford was offered the same deal, considered the options, and decided not to do it.
All right. Well, that presumably would be the basis for regulators saying, look, you had your chance. You're out in the cold. You know, good luck to you. We've got bigger fish to fry here with General Motors. Let me talk to you about another conflict, which I'm wondering about. It may be completely the result of my paranoid fantasies. But is it possible because the government owns AIG as well as General Motors now, that it's in a conflict of interest situation because, in theory, it holds both the fate of the debt held by GM creditors, right? I mean,
some of it.
Uh-huh. But it also holds the insurance policies that some of those debtors bought on, say, General Motors bonds, for instance, that AIG may have these weird credit default swap insurance policies of. So it's possible that the government is obligated to both give, say, 10 cents on the dollar to a bondholder for GM, but also pay out their insurance policy at 90 cents on the dollar, and we're on the hook for all that. Is that possible, and does that make any sense to you?
I guess it's possible, but it seems somewhat remote because most of the credit default swaps that we are aware of, and I could well be missing something here, were not in the territory of the GM bonds. But it's, you know, it's an interesting question to ask, but I've not seen any evidence yet that that's a problem. The much bigger problem with AIG and with GM, I think, is the problem of exit strategy. And at what point do you get to the point where either one of these companies is stable enough that you can actually sell it back into the private market? And I think President Obama is very sincere when he says he does want to get rid of them. But think about the tension here, John. We could sell the GM shares as a government back to private investors next year, which they say they want to do. They say they want to get rid of it in 2010. But if you sell too early, you're not going to get back the full investment that taxpayers have put into it, which right now is $50 billion,
right,
with a B, and climbing, right?
Sure.
If you wait a while and the company actually does get on its feet and they actually do start building cars that people want to buy and that are profitable, and the car market comes back, and the key bet here is how quickly you get back to a good-sized car market, then you might actually get that money back.
So
but doing
so,
that means holding on longer.
So the longer you hold on, the bigger the regulatory headaches and the legal problems that we were talking about, the quicker you sell, the less money you make, and the more you just take a financial bath with the taxpayers' money.
And a little bit of the Iraq problem, which is you pull out too quickly, you don't know what chaos will ensue.
And if GM goes down, that's a political liability for Barack Obama headed straight into the off-year election. Okay, that makes total sense to me. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. And I did not know this, David runs a support group for men who own Hummers down in the Washington, D.C. area. David, thanks so much for being on the program. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.